Dr. Bossert will be speaking to us this morning on the subject of the human mind evolved. The credentials for Dr. Bossert are listed for you again in the front of our Origin Seminar notebooks. He is president of D.C. Bossert Systems Analysis. You may think it a striking accident that the name of his company is fairly similar to his own name, but that actually is evidence of design. Dr. Bossert is a contractor for the federal government in a more direct way than our paying income taxes makes us contractors for the federal government in the area of systems analysis, computer evaluation of all sorts of scenarios. I don't know what particular ones he's into. He has a bachelor's and master's degree in physics, the bachelor's from Drexel and the master's from Dartmouth. Also has a master's degree in mathematics from Dartmouth and a doctorate in math from Dartmouth, and a Master of Divinity from Biblical Theological Seminary. and his wife spent a number of years living in the mainline Philadelphia area in a big, what shall we say, handyman special mansion on the main line, and renting out parts of it to students at the various colleges there. They have now moved up into New Hampshire, where they are continuing the systems analysis and analyzing the systems of maple trees and producing maple sugar and other sorts of things. But Dave has been interested in the question of the human mind and sort of the computer aspects of it for a long time. And I think that's what we're going to hear about today. We'll find out
what I wanted to do. Actually, that's correct. I had to express my specialty in a word. It's modeling. I do mathematical modeling. And one of the areas that is particularly interesting to me is, how does the mind work? What I'd like you to do, perhaps this morning, is just sort of do a little daydreaming, hopefully with one ear paying more or less attention. And actually, perhaps as homework, after we're done here, most of what I'm saying is in one of the papers you're going to have, Beyond the Shadow of a Doubt. So if I don't give you some of the details of some of the experiments I'm going to talk about, and some of the specific numbers that are involved, you can check the article, the paper, and it will go into some of those details. But modeling is the name of the game in my profession, and I would also claim that modeling is what your mind does. Your mind models more than you think, and we'll get into that a little bit. We've been talking the last day or so about some of the dilemmas of evolution. Last night we heard the dilemma of how does light form in the first place. We also learned the dilemma, we understand, you can conceive of how microevolution works, and things moving systematic, small with small changes between similar things. But there's a dilemma, how do the jumps occur in macroevolution? We learned a little bit about that just a few minutes ago. Behind all of this is something which is almost assumed nowadays, but I think, at least when I was growing up, it was a totally new concept, and that is the whole idea of the genetic code. The fact that inside each of our cells is a very elaborate computer program, like you might call it. It's almost literally a computer program because it's discrete, it's digital. Digital in the very real sense, not that we have zeros and ones in the way of computers, but we have actually the amino acids, like 20 different kinds of digits, you might say, which determine what we are, determine all kinds of way down the line changes. In other words, it's hard enough for us who are building a piece of machinery to get the first level of things right. And we're building an engine, and the engine turns. Okay, that's kind of the first level. And the second level is what it turns does something else. What that does is something else. And one of the amazing things about the genetic code is that it has effects sort of like 10 levels removed from where it's at now. So you have cells that grow and grow into babies, and then babies grow into adults, and the adults grow, and as the adults that do the things that produce more babies and so forth and so on. I mean, that's sort of a very down the line kind of inference. And it's all contained in this genetic code. Well, that's not what I'm talking about today, but I have a hard trouble keeping on track. How do you make changes in the genetic code? Well, we talk about microevolution being small changes. If you have a genetic code that says CAT, I suppose that means cat, then, you know, it's easy to see how very simple changes can make that into FAT, okay? You change a C to an F. Or you can make a hat, or you can make a bat. So the cat and the bat and the hat are all the same, are all microevolutions from each other. But it's kind of hard to make a turkey out of a cat by microevolution, because the turkey requires such changes in the, we're talking in sort of a humorous way, in the code or the alphabet, that you'd have to go through a lot of intermediate stages that don't make any sense at all. And that's the problem of the macroevolution. You can see how if you have a very elaborate, never mind how the code got there, but if you have a very elaborate genetic code, you can make small changes in that code and get other things that are similar but different, okay? But how do you go from something that has a three-part heart to something that has a four-part heart? I mean, that's a dramatic change. And as it just being mentioned in the last hour, they come in packages, like the Cadillac and the Volkswagen. Anyway, that's still not what I'm talking about. But models, however, one thing that is a model is saying what it means by the genetic code making changes. Now you're getting into the area of models. We already mentioned a simple model. You just change a few little bits in the genetic code. But there are other models for making changes in the genetic code. And this is the area where I think the next, I kind of think in long term, next century or two, if we survive. The reason I say century or two is because I think the plain fact is the scientific world is getting into an age of investigation that is exceedingly difficult. And progress is going to be fast in one sense, but in comparison with what's needed, it's going to be extremely slow, and we'll make lots of mistakes and so forth. One of the things that we will learn something about over the next century or so, in fact, I keep saying that I wish I were starting out now. I mean, you know, I got to say this, because it seems to me the world is so exciting now. There's so many things happening. Anyway, whatever. Models. The simple model says A changes to B, or C for cat changes to B for bats. And cats and bats are homologous. Another model for a genetic code would be, here's a long genetic code. You take a piece here, and you insert it over here. Okay? So you could get a different sequence, not by just taking one thing and switching an amino acid or something, but by actually taking chunks and moving chunks around. This is the so-called jumping genes notion. There are other models of how you make changes genetically. And, what I've talked about are what are called random switches, which would tend to happen by irradiation. The other change, transpositions, where you take a chunk of genetic code and move it to another spot. And then there are things called catenation, where you would take two pieces of genetic code and just put them end to end. All these things form models. And it's the way we understand what goes on in the world. We understand what goes on scientifically by means of models. Now that's basically what I want to talk about, is how does the mind work? How does the mind do what it does? And as you very well guessed, being a mathematician, you can make a model. What I say is the mind works primarily by means of models. The next question would be, can the mind do whatever it is it does without some kind of intelligence behind it? And to discuss that a little bit, what I am going to go into is a little bit of the research that has been done in artificial intelligence in the last 10, 20 years. Used to be, artificial intelligence is sort of a very strange word, which means lots of things to lots of people. To me, the way I think of artificial intelligence is nothing more than what we used to call operations research 20 years ago. My company has done operations research, but now we call it artificial intelligence. But really all it is just mathematics, at least from my point of view. But let's start off with the question of the human mind. Let's just think a little bit about what the human mind does. And maybe if you have a better idea of what the human mind does, then we can maybe start thinking about what kind of models would be required to describe it. First page of the notes, I start off even more fundamentally with some definitions. And here's an interesting thing.
There are certain biases in academia, and one of those biases is a tendency to define terms in kind of intellectual ways, as opposed to defining terms in a way that is practical, or that it says, in other words, an intellectual way of describing something, or an academic way, or a rational way of describing something, is to say sort of functionally what it should be, how it should be put together. To describe it practically would be to say what it does. And it's very interesting, just look on the first page, to see that this contention is working here. Look at the definition of reason. The Oxford Dictionary's definition of reason is primarily a practical definition. It says what reason does. Whereas Webster's definition of reason is primarily an analytical definition. It doesn't say what it does, it says what it should do, I guess you might say. Oxford, the intellectual power, this is reason, the intellectual power or faculty, which is ordinarily employed in adapting thought or action to some end. In other words, just doing something. Webster's definition, the power of comprehending, inferring, or thinking in orderly, rational ways. It's a very different kind of definition. Let's look at the word wisdom. Again, Oxford Dictionary. Practical. The capacity of judging rightly. That's a practical application. And matters relating to life and conduct. Even more practical. Soundness of judgment in the choice of means and ends. Webster's definition. Accumulated philosophic and scientific learning. The ability to discern interqualities and relationships. Now, that's an interesting observation. That even in the definitions of the words, you can have a definition of a word that is primarily expressed in terms of what it does, or you can have a definition of words expressed primarily in terms of rational concepts. And this is a little deeper than perhaps it might appear on the surface, because there is a basic contention in academic pursuits between the idea of wisdom being something that is fundamentally a practical thing, and the idea of wisdom being something that is fundamentally a rational or academic thing. We'll get to that in a few minutes. What I want to do, being kind of with an engineering background, even though I'm a mathematician, my background really is engineering, is look at the mind and ask ourselves how the mind works, not from the viewpoint of something theoretical, but from the viewpoint of getting right down to the nuts and bolts. And let's perform a few little thought experiments and ask ourselves, what are we doing? And, and when I'm saying this, what I really would like to have you be doing is kind of thinking to yourself, sort of listen to me with one ear, and kind of thinking to yourself, what is it that I do in these particular areas? So I'm going to just mention a few areas: visual recall, visual recognition, and speech and communications. In visual recall, let's particularly concentrate on something like unexpected recall, where you're asked to recall something that you did some circumstance you were in, and you weren't expecting to be asked that question. The classic example is an accident or a crime is committed, and you're asked to recollect what happened. Well, you know, nobody said 5 minutes from now there's going to be an accident, and I want you to be sure to observe the whole scene so you know everything, and you have it, because you're going to be asked in detail what happened. That's not what happens. Let's take a much simpler case of unexpected recall. Suppose I ask you right now to some questions about your motel room or your dormitory or whatever it was you were staying in last night. But I ask you what kind of ceiling you have on your room. How many can you answer that? What kind of ceiling? Is it plaster? Is it wood? Okay. Well, you didn't expect me to ask that question, did you? That's an example of unexpected recall. An example of expected recall would be, where did you park your car in the shopping mall? Okay? Everyone knows that I always have the residual fear that I'm going to go to the shopping mall and I'll never buy a car again. Because even aside from the fact it might be stolen. Unexpected recall is a particular problem from the viewpoint of trying to understand how the mind works, because how is it that you are able to answer these questions? What kind of ceiling is a very trivial one. I could ask you all kinds of questions about the room you stayed in last night, and you could make fairly rational, reasonable answers. How do you do it? I'll tell you one way you do not do it. You do not do it by forming in your brain photographic images of everything you have done. It's obvious you don't do that. In fact, you can show mathematically you don't do that, because the amount of detail, the amount of information you would have to be able to convey from your head, from your eyes to your head, let's say, in the case of visual recall, would just overwhelm the circuits. You just don't have that much capacity in your visual nerves and all the things that go from your eyes to your brain. You just don't have the capacity. In fact, that was an interesting question I kind of looked into, and I was a little frustrated because people don't think the same way I think, and these psychologists and so forth, they're not thinking in terms of channel capacity and all those sorts of things that computer people think about. But the best I could figure out, the data rate from your eye to your brain is in the order of 1,000 bits per second maximum. And, you know, playing back, if anybody knows anything about conveying TV signals or doing any kind of communications, realizes that is a very, 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 very small, minuscule data rate. You can't store hardly anything at that kind of a data rate. Never mind the capacity of your brain to record these images. You say the brain has maybe in the order of a trillion cells. Well, that sounds like an awful lot. But anybody who's been working with computers recently, 10 years ago, if you had a computer that would have a memory of 64,000 characters, you say, man, that's a big computer. Nowadays, you know, 64,000 characters, you can hardly even turn around in it. It's just a small amount. Nowadays, you'll have a little IBM computer that'll have a 300 million character disk drive. Well, you know, you don't have to go very much further, and we'll be talking about trillions of characters with storage, and you'll be complaining because that's not nearly enough. And the plain fact is, even though the brain has a trillion cells or so, that's not nearly enough for actual, literal, visual copying of what you see. You don't do that. What do you do? Well, that's a very interesting question. And the answer is that you probably is. That what you really do when you can perform visual recall is you don't really remember a scene. You just remember a few little pieces of the scene, and then you embed those little pieces in kind of a framework of what you would expect to see in similar circumstances. One way you can sort of get a feeling for that is if you think about what happens when you're momentarily disoriented. I'm sure all of you have, at one time or another, had the very strange feeling of, either it happens instantaneously during the day, or sometimes it happens when you wake up. You momentarily kind of lose grip, you lose the grip of where you are and what you're doing. And, you know, it's those moments of disorientation that give you a good feel for how much the orientation, the scene that you're working in, determines your understanding of your environment. And I would claim that when you're doing visual recall, especially unexpected visual recall, all you are really doing is you have remembered a few little bits. And what you have is a familiar scene, a room, or whatever it is, and you have a few little bits, and you just remember those bits embedded in that familiar scene. You don't have a photograph of a Volkswagen bug in your mind. If somebody asks you questions about a Volkswagen bug, you can give some rough answers about how big is a Volkswagen bug, about how many wheels does it have. Well, that's not too hard. About what's its rough shape? How many windows does a Volkswagen bug have in it? Now, you know, you never knew that I was going to ask you that question, but I bet you that I could just sort of mentally count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and it was these events, two more, it's 8. All kinds of questions. But you don't have this. You don't have a photographic map of a bug. So, this illustrates one thing. I want to keep on moving, so I don't want to spend a lot of time talking about the other examples that are there: visual recognition, speech, and communications. You can read those in the paper. Incidentally, this business about visual recall, you can see immediately a problem that arises with the human mind, and that is if you are asked to recall something and you are asked questions that sort of work beyond the few pieces of information you did record,
you may very well extrapolate from those few pieces of information you did record using your familiar scene and come up with false information. One of the things that always struck me as kind of strange is the emphasis that law enforcement officers put on things like lineups and the ability to recognize a face and a crime that occurred in an instant and things like that. I know for myself, I would be totally unreliable in that area because, in fact, it wouldn't even be lying. It would be that I would have embedded those ideas in a kind of a matrix of what the person looked like or whatever it is. But that matrix might be a little too malleable. It might be something that, you know, upon thinking about it again, that matrix might change a little bit, or maybe, you know, you can just sort of see the picture. And I think that's the way the mind works. It is a very malleable thing. Some people would say that it's not a good model, that it's not a good kind of thing for the mind to be doing. The mind should be more precise. The mind should be getting a clearer picture. But there is one fundamental fact about the mind, and that is that the mind works. If you were an engineer trying to design a device that would do what the mind does in visual recall, you would be totally overwhelmed by the amount of data you would have to process. One of the mistakes that people make in evaluating the mind and its work, that's why I'm emphasizing this point about practicality as opposed to theoretical qualities. I believe the mind is a remarkable piece of equipment primarily because it works in the face of overwhelming odds. You just look at the problem of visual recall. It is just overwhelming what the mind does, that it can actually make sense out of this. Now, some people who talk about the creator of the mind, and I'm thinking particularly of Stephen Jay Gould, who seems to love to write these little, very popular booklets, kind of putting down the creator. I think Stephen Jay Gould has a bone to chew, a bone to pick, because he was one of the people who started this punctuated equilibrium stuff that we talked about last night, and he feels very defensive because a lot of creationists have picked up on that, and so that sounds like a pretty good argument for a creator. And since he didn't want to have that happen, he also wrote these books, like one's called The Panda's Thumb, and so forth. And one of his points that he's making is he's sort of poking fun at the engineer who created this mediocre stuff that we call humanity, human eye. He said, he would say something like, in fact, I think he talked specifically about the human eye. The human eye is only a very mediocre, imperfect device. Well, you know, from a viewpoint of a person who's building Leica cameras and so forth and so on, perhaps there are some qualities about the eye that strike him as kind of mediocre. Perhaps it's not the best lens in the world and so forth and so on. But the plain fact is, the overriding fact about the mind-eye combination is it works. It works in the face of overwhelming data. Overwhelming data flows. And that, to me, is the telling feature. Now, as time passes, I would say offhand right now, the understanding of exactly how the mind works and things like visual recognition is very primitive, and I think as time passes, it'll get better. As we learn about computers, it'll get better. Right now, we're in the computer age, and we're at the point where we can do sequential processing pretty well. Sequential processing means you do first one thing, and then you do the next thing, and then you do the next thing, and then you do the next thing. And we're getting to kind of a limit of sequential processing. We're not getting things 100 times faster, 1,000 times faster, and so forth. But now, our way of thinking about the way the mind works and the way brains work has in the past been kind of dominated by the idea of sequential processing. First, I have to do this, and I have to do that, and I have to do that, and I have to do that. Whereas now we're starting to think in computer science of parallel processing, where you have a whole bunch of people, like a whole bunch of secretaries sitting in an office all typing letters. And you can get more letters done than if you just have one secretary passing the information to the next one or whatever it is. Even so, I think the evidence still is that the I think it'll be a long time before we will understand how the mind handles all the data stream, all the flow of information we have to have. So I guess the purpose of this particular part of the talk is simply to get you in the mood to thinking in terms of evaluating the mind, not so much from the viewpoint of its technical and theoretical capacities, parameters, but how it does its job and how it gets its job done. And the answer is, from a practical viewpoint, it gets its job done very well.
Our next question comes up: what is the meaning of intelligence? What do we mean by intelligence? Now, here I mentioned this a little bit earlier in the talk, that there are kind of two streams of thought, one heading towards the analytic definition of things, and the other heading toward the practical definition of things. And I was very pleased that the previous speaker mentioned Proverbs 8, because one of the fundamental facts of life, in fact, if you're into philosophy and so forth, you would find this very interesting to check up on and follow through on yourself. There are the Western science as it is practiced in the West, is dominated by the Greek line of thinking. And the Greek line of thinking is very different from the Hebrew line of thinking. I'll tell you, give you a good example of how you can realize how much you are yourself dominated by the Greek line of thinking. In latest Leviticus, there is a passage that talks about the craftsmen who were building the temple, the tabernacle. And it says in the King James, at least, that the craftsmen were filled with wisdom as they were building the tabernacle. And you know, to a person who is kind of raised in the Greek kind of thought, the Greek line of philosophy, it sounds kind of incongruous to talk about a craftsman being filled with wisdom, because you think of wisdom as being, you know, thinking about theorems and mathematical formulas and all that sort of stuff, and logic and all these paradigms and so forth and so on. Whereas in the Hebrew thought, wisdom was really the ability to do something very well. With a practical capability. And so the NIV, for example, translates that particular verse filled with skill and ability. I think it is a skill. Is it the skill and ability? I'm not sure exactly. It's something like that. I think I have it written in notes. Skill and ability. Well, that is interesting, because we, in our minds, in our whole culture, we distinguish between wisdom, which is an intellectual thing, which is a theoretical thing, from, we distinguish between that and skill and ability, the ability to do things. In the Hebrew mind, that was merged. And in fact, one of the interesting things is the personification of wisdom in Proverbs chapter 8. The wisdom that is personified is primarily not some mathematical genius, but it is a person, it is a wisdom that is capable of doing eminently practical things. And if you read through Proverbs chapter 8, and you read about wisdom in Proverbs chapter 8, the thing that will really hit you is how practical it is, or how much that wisdom is tied up with doing things with his hands and getting things accomplished that work. And you know, with a capital W, they work. And that is, in fact, the glorious thing about God's creation, that it works. It is an eminently workable thing. Now, you take people like Stephen Jay Gould, and they'll be complaining about how it's not technically excellent. Who really cares whether it's technically excellent if it works? In fact, if it was technically excellent, it probably wouldn't work. Because, you know, if you had the perfect lens in your eye, the perfect lens isn't anything without the ability to correctly interpret what it is you're seeing. And that's a whole other area. That's another area, one of the areas that I skipped back there. The whole idea of visual perception, or visual perception would be, in Scientific American, one of the colonists there who writes very often, Dudney, wrote a column about the perceptron. He was writing about this little black box that is programmed so it will find a cat wherever it sees one. So, you know, you take this black box and you go walking down the scene, you go walking down your neighborhood, and as soon as it sees a cat, a little red light goes on and says, that's a cat. And you keep on going, and it finds another cat, that's a cat. Finds a dog, no, it's not a cat. And this perceptron, which is a fictional device, of course,
designed so it'll know exactly what a cat is, and it'll be able to recognize a cat when it sees it, and it'll never make a mistake.
Well, that was sort of like the lead-in to the observation that the ability to recognize things is a very subtle thing. And in fact, those of you again who are into philosophy, that was one of the big hang-ups that Plato had in the Latin Greek philosophy. Because Plato, he had his concept of the ideal. His question would be, how do you recognize a chair? Why is that a problem? Because chairs come in so many different ways, different forms. So Plato had the idea that really there's an ideal chair. There's somewhere up in the sky, there's this thing called a chair. And somehow that chair is there, and everything else is just a faulty example of the chair. But somehow, because we have this ideal of the chair, we know what a chair is, because we look at the chair, that's a chair. In fact, Socrates went a step further and said that because that's the case, therefore, we have to have all this inborn knowledge in our minds, because we wouldn't be able to do anything without that inborn knowledge. Therefore, in our minds, there is the concept. In fact, all wisdom is actually already in our minds, and the job of a teacher is not to not to put stuff into our minds, but actually to draw it out. That's the Socratic method. The Socratic method is to draw stuff out of our minds. Well, this is all getting around to the fact that the mind works. The mind works in a remarkable way, and it does its job in the face of overwhelming odds, in the face of overwhelming amounts of data that it might have to work with, and it is able to do its work very well. Okay, we're back to the meaning of intelligence. So I mentioned the Greek versus the Hebrew concept of wisdom, and sort of an analytical versus a practical definition of wisdom. And it's good to keep that in mind, not so much that you have to change your attitude towards life, but just to realize that we are really dominated by the Greek point of view in our life. Anybody who knows anything about the history of the Western academia will realize that we're really dominated by the Greek point of view. The development of the Western concept of wisdom is a very interesting subject, because basically you started off with the realization way back maybe 5, 6, 7 centuries BC in the Western thought, meaning the Greek line, with the concept that there are realities outside of ourselves. And this kind of led to mathematics kind of naturally. I guess in this particular group it's no problem talking about mathematics. When I was in a church in Virginia, they thought mathematics meant you could add two numbers together. But the plain fact is mathematics, at least as I practice it, has nothing to do with the ability to add two numbers together. I hope you understand that. Mathematics is logical. It's thinking logically. And thinking logically about things, there are logical relationships that exist in the world independent of they're external to the mind. But if science is the search to find these things that exist independent of the mind, there's a fundamental difficulty, and this fundamental difficulty has to do with the faulty eye, the faulty perception. And that is that the senses that we use to learn about us, learn about the things that are around us, are faulty. We know that. We know that I could think somebody is sitting right over there, and the reason I think that is because there is a... because the light waves are curved around, and he's sitting over there, but I think he's over there. In fact, I might think that Dr. Newman is, maybe he's an illusion, maybe he's not even real. I don't know. There's no way that I can tell. Prove it. There's no way I can prove that you're, I think you just popped right here, just now. Bernard Shaw? We had an interesting comment about that. Well, I won't get into that. Anyway. The senses are faulty. So the question from the viewpoint of the advancement of science is, if I know there are real facts out there, true facts, let's say, but I know that my senses are faulty, how do I advance science? How do I gain wisdom? How do I gain knowledge? And that was a real obstacle in science from the time of Aristotle on up to the time of Newton, approximately, or Galileo, or the general time era, because it seemed to be almost an impassable barrier. And then at the time of Newton, now again, thinking through the train of the Western concept of wisdom, but at the time of Newton, the concept, a very emancipating concept came up, and that is the concept of the repeatable experiment. The repeatable experiment says, I don't care if my senses are faulty. If I can pose an experiment that I can do, and I get certain results, and you over there can do, and you get the same results, and enough people do it and get the same results, then even though we have each individually have faulty senses, get in the consensus, we can come by truth. We can come by real facts. And so, in the Western train of wisdom, of scientific development, the fact of the reproducible experiment became a very important releasing thing. It became a thing that will help us to advance beyond the fact that we have faulty senses, which indeed we do. But the concept of the reproducible experiment, I think you would say, it's fair to say, that between 1850 and 1950, let's say, this is a good period of time, there was a period of time in which the idea of the reproducible experiment was thought to be all there is to it. And that all there is to science is just stating hypotheses, stating the results of reproducible experiments, and that's the end of it. And that if any theory is true, you prove it's true by citing experiments which demonstrate it's true. I would think it's probably fair to say, at least it's been we've been hit over the head with the fact, that only in the past 30 years is it starting to be realized that that really is kind of a conceited notion of what science is all about. Science doesn't prove things. What really happens in science, now this gets a little controversial, what really happens in science is you don't state things that are proved true. What you really do is state things that can be tested and proved false. And it is really by the process of falsifying things that you learn. Now, the reason for making a statement like that is because of an asymmetry in logic. The asymmetry is you can never prove a universal truth. If I say, let's take what's a universal truth? I don't know.
Okay, if I say 2 plus 2 equals 4, I'm not sure that's, well, of course, yeah, I guess that's what we mean. If I say 2 plus 2 is 4,
universal truth. You can't prove, it is a mathematical fact, you can't prove a universal truth because you'd have to show every possible instance of it is true. And you just can't do that. However, you can show that a false statement is false with a single example, with a single counterexample. So in logic, truth cannot be proved, but falsity can be demonstrated. If I say all crows are black, and you show me one example of a white crow, then that falsifies my statement. The statement is no longer true. And is that asymmetry in logic, which has led some people like Karl Popper, as an example, good example, to state that in fact, contrary to our notion about the scientific, the experiment on basis of science, in fact, science really proceeds, advances by posing hypotheses that can be then demonstrated to be false. And what happens is, you make a hypothesis, and somebody works with it, works fine for a while, and somebody shows it's false. Well, what happens then is, you don't abandon the hypothesis, you modify the hypothesis, and it's by the process of modifying the hypothesis that you end up with an approximation to truth. But you never know that things are really true. Primarily, intelligence is something that is practical. Now let's turn to some of the experiments in artificial intelligence. Because now, if we're going to talk about, in the ultimate sense, artificial intelligence is an attempt to have machines do whatever it is that the mind does. And again, the history of artificial intelligence is probably a history from naivety, very overly simplistic notions of things to sort of a much more realistic notion today, perhaps. I don't know if you want to call it realistic or not. The Turing experiment. Turing, T Q-R-I-N-G, was an early mathematician. He was actually very heavily involved in World War II in breaking the German codes and actually provided a great assistance to the Allied efforts in World War II. After World War II, he turned his theory of code breaking was turned into some of the early research into computers and how computers work. And he proposed an experiment in which he argued, as a result of that, if the experiment was successfully conducted, that we could produce a computer that would do, that would be as good as a human mind. The experiment was something like this. You get two people, you sit down at the two people were in different rooms, to say, and they have a teletype connecting them, or whatever kind of video display terminal, or whatever you call it. And the idea is that a human being sitting at a terminal, typing questions to whatever it is on the other side, and the other thing on the other side replies and gives answers back. And Turing would claim that if you could devise a computer who was so smart that no matter what questions the human would ask at one end, he couldn't tell whether that was a computer on the other end. You know, that was the test. Put a computer over there or a human, you don't know which. This guy asks questions, and the guy gives answers. This guy asks questions, and the guy gives answers. And the Turing experiment is this person tries to figure out whether that person is a human being or whether that person is a computer. If you can't tell the difference, then for practical purposes, the computer is as good as a human being, if in fact it was a computer. Well, that particular experiment was very popular, I guess, in the 50s. But the Turing experiment, as time passed, people began to realize that how complicated the human mind was, and the corollary is it appeared difficult and impossible at that point to successfully conduct a Turing experiment. Turing himself predicted by about 1990, which is not too far away, we would be able to have computers who were as intelligent as humans as he defined. Intelligent meaning a person on the computer couldn't a person typing into a computer couldn't tell whether it was a computer replying. That has been now considered no longer capable. In fact, because of the fact that human minds are complex. Learning machines. I have a quote. I wanted to. In fact, there's a quote at the beginning of my notes here. Learning machines were sort of a computer version of the concept of tabula rasa, the blank slate idea. The blank slate idea is that the way a baby learns, for example, is he starts with a completely blank slate. He has no information at all. And as he goes through life, information is put into his head, and he gradually learns enough to become a functioning human being. Well, I always claim that anybody who ever had any kids would immediately realize that is a bunch of malarkey. That in fact, a baby comes with all kinds of knowledge already existing in his head. But nonetheless, it was a very popular concept among the theoreticians, some of the early philosophers in the 17th and 18th centuries. Tabula rasa concept. Well, the idea of the learning machine was the same idea. Putting information into a computer so that eventually it would learn to act in an adult way. One of the ideas that has fascinated the Western mind is that there is a general purpose learning mechanism that accounts for almost all the state of an adult human being. According to this idea, people are born knowing very little and absorb almost everything by way of this general learner. This idea is still powerfully attractive. It underlies much of behavioral psychology. AI students often rediscover it and propose to dispense with the study of reasoning and problem solving, instead build a baby and let it just learn these things. We believe this idea is dead, killed off by research in artificial intelligence. What this research has revealed is that for an organism to learn anything, it must already know a lot. And that's kind of the dilemma that we're led to in the whole subject of the human mind. And we'll read the quote at the top of the notes here, which kind of leads to that.
Learning begins with organized knowledge, which grows and becomes better organized. Without strong clues as to what is to be learned, nothing will get learned. And that is kind of the idea of what the human mind does in a nutshell. But the research and experiment in artificial intelligence has emphasized how exceedingly complex the operation of the mind is, and how relatively impossible it is to duplicate it, at least within anything we have in our state of understanding, by means of artificial intelligence or computers. There are a couple of other examples given in the paper that you can read. I wanted to get down to the kind of the synthesis of what I've been talking about, and that is, how does the mind work? And I hinted at some of this in the examples I gave earlier. I believe the mind is now, you must understand now, this is my biases as a mathematician. I spent my whole life modeling, so I will naturally think the whole world fits into my mold. But I believe the way the mind works is by a process of modeling, which basically means taking an object and trying to say what that object does in terms of discrete steps. We talked earlier about the DNA. How does the DNA change? Well, the discrete steps might be the random altering of a key, of an element in the DNA change. That would be the sort of change you would expect to occur with a radiation. That's, in fact, one of the reasons why they think that they put a lot of emphasis on the role of radiation, because the radiation will hit these elements of the change and either break the chain or also change one of the elements or somehow pop one out, another one goes in, or something like that. That would be the one kind of model of DNA change. The other kind of model would be, or another part of the model might be, transpositions, the so-called jumping genes, and so forth. But when we come to any subject that we are to deal with, the first thing the mind does is have a general model, a frame, a notion of how this thing should work. Where does that model come from? Well, in many cases, according to that quote of the notes, if you don't have something to start with, you don't get very far. So the idea being that in order to really work, the mind has got to have some prior hints as to what to do. There were some experiments done just a couple years ago, and probably still continuing, the ability of newborn infants to control their muscles in what you might call indirect ways. They would take an infant who had just born about an hour or two ago, and they would have a person in front of it and start smiling or making facial expressions, and they would discover that this infant would mimic those facial expressions. Now you ask yourself, you sort of say, What is it that, first of all, tells that infant that there's something going on here that you got to copy, okay? Secondly, what tells it that even when I wanted to copy it, that this is the way to do it? That, scrunching up my mouth here is the way to, or wiggling my nose is the way to copy what that thing that I'm looking at is doing. In order for the infant to do that, the infant already has to have a pretty good idea that this is. Maybe he doesn't think in terms of human, but this is something that is like me, and even though I can't see my nose, if he's wiggling his nose, I can wiggle my nose too. If he's smiling, I can smile too. And I'm sure the logic is not quite that well developed at that point. But there is something there. You can't do it without having something there. And you go through all the activities of the human life, and if you think of these things as little snapshots, little cameos of what's going on, in each case, the argument of this sort would be that sort of an extrapolation of that quote at the beginning of the article of the notes. The idea would be that you really can't get anywhere unless you already start with something. And that basically is one of the fundamental conclusions of artificial intelligence, that you can't get anywhere unless you have a good idea of where you're going, which kind of leads to the idea that reasoning is built up of models, sort of a basic concept of what's going on there, and a process which says how the concept proceeds, how the concept works,
And then algorithms, which are algorithms, would be the mathematical or the logical expression of how these algorithms, how these processes work. Now, I was just actually, as I was thinking last night and today about the DNA and hearing Bloom's talk and some of these other talks, I was just thinking, well, it would be a lot of fun to write a little computer program which would take into account some of these changes. I'm sure it's been done in a simple program. I'm sure it's been done in a complicated way. But take some of these changes that would lead to microevolution and just sort of model them up in some way so you could sort of beat off these random changes of one key against transpositions and so on and see what you come up with. But that's the sort of way that artificial intelligence has got to work now. In fact, that's why progress in artificial intelligence is now seen to be a very slow process. It used to be people thought, man, we get these powerful computers and we just sort of set them humming and we just feed in a big database and they'll make all their inferences. They'll be able to, you know, make a lot of progress that way. Now it is thought, but before we even bother putting stuff into the computer, we better do a lot of thinking. And we better be able to codify things and get a good idea of how things go. Then we put them into the computer, and then we can push the button and better get some useful results out. That process of doing the modeling and doing the process construction and doing the algorithm development, that is not done by computers. That's got to be done by human beings. And that's the tough part. That's the prior knowledge. You know, without knowing what to do, you can't do very much. And that's the application to computers is computers can't do much unless you tell them what to do. And it's perhaps a little deeper than that sounds. Okay? Finally, we've got to finish up. Just a sort of in summary and conclusion, the source of intelligence. I believe that artificial intelligence, as work in artificial intelligence, shows pretty conclusively that we can't begin with nothing. We can't begin with a blank slate. A blank slate will not get you very far. And so to that extent, I would argue that, again, we've been very, very nasty on evolution the last couple of days, showing all kinds of ways that it causes big difficulties. Well, the big difficulty from the viewpoint of the mind is, where are you going to get that in there? Where are you going to get that knowledge? Where's the source of that innate knowledge? You can't get somewhere without something already to start with. And, of course, my belief would be that that knowledge comes from God, the ultimate source of intelligence. The implications for current research, as I mentioned before, that research is not just a matter of getting powerful computers. The research is a matter of we have to somehow construct those models of how the mind works and put them into the computers. That's very tough work. I believe that in fact, in mathematical terms, the growth of progress in artificial intelligence would be logarithmic, not exponential. Now, computers are growing exponentially. What that means is they're becoming twice as powerful, let's say, every 7 or 8 years. And that's a fact. Exponential growth, meaning things are becoming twice as good every 8 years as far as power goes. But my guess is that artificial intelligence, because of the complexities of mind, artificial intelligence grows logarithmically, which means it grows, but man, it is a slow process. And it's going to be a long time before before science is able to match what God has put in the human mind. For more details, you can look at that paper, which I believe was handed out. A few more details, a little more numerical results, and there's some references there that are also very interesting. I guess that's about all I have to say.